Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What makes the English language, with all its curious regional quirks, such a delightful thing to ponder? And where do you turn when you want to know why we express ourselves in the ways we do? A lot of KERA listeners make a weekly appointment to check in with my guest today, two experts on language with a particular interest in its colloquial use, who are every bit as curious about language as the audience they serve. Martha Barnett and Grant Barrett are co-hosts of Away with Words, which can be heard on this station every Saturday afternoon at 1. They're in town for a fundraiser event tomorrow night at the Lakewood Theater in Dallas to benefit the Aberg Center for Literacy. Grant, Martha, welcome to Think.
Hey there.
Thanks for having us.
So do you find yourselves listening to language more intently when you travel to different parts of the country?
Yeah, absolutely.
It starts with the in-flight magazine and goes from there.
We were just talking about the in-flight magazine.
And then the cab driver and the people at the front desk at the hotel and the service staff that you see in the hallways. Everywhere.
And I'm from Kentucky originally, and I heard myself just slipping into more and more and more southern-sounding speech, which thrilled me.
Yeah, you sound like you should be drinking iced tea right now.
Although it's funny that a lot of people now who grow up in this part of the country don't necessarily have what people think of as the old-school Texas accent.
No, the old-school Texas accent is disappearing, and there's a new Texas accent. I mean, Texans still are very distinct in their speech, but it's not the same one. You can listen to the historical tapes and hear folks recorded in the 40s and 50s, and it's wonderful, but it's just not around much anymore. Those folks are mostly gone.
It's luscious when you hear it, though.
It is. Oh, it's homey, right? It's comfortable, makes you feel like you're coming home, having a gathering where there's going to be good food or something like that.
Yeah, it's delicious. That's a great way to describe it.
Well, let me ask you this, because many people in this part of the country, we know that you can have a really heavy accent and be very, very smart and accomplished. Why is it that sort of the general perception is that the more regional you sound, the less intelligent you sound?
What a loaded question. How much time do we have today?
We've got an hour.
Can we do 6 hours on this?
But
you know what I'm saying? I mean, I grew up in Long Island and I
used to
speak that way. Yes. And I don't have the accent anymore, but people think that that makes you sound not very smart. And I'm just curious about that.
There's a particular type of sociolinguistic study that's done, and I'm not going to get too wonky and nerdy about this, but the results are almost always wonderful. And what they do is they've done this in Texas even recently. I think it was at UT Austin. They'll ask people what they think of the speech of people elsewhere and compare it to the speech that they think that they use. And inevitably, people put themselves almost in the center, except if they have been told repeatedly throughout their lives that they sound stupid. And then they'll put themselves on the outer edges of unacceptable. And it's really interesting to see that we spend a great deal of time judging people around the country, but inaccurately. We have these wrong ideas about their speech and wrong ideas about our own speech. Texans are used to being told that they sound dumb, and so are people in the South. And it's really interesting. And I got to say this. I think one of the reasons that I love our show is we put genuine Southern voices on the air. And outside of Ellen Beardsley, who is the Paris correspondent for NPR, and Roy Blunt Jr., who's occasionally on Wait, Wait, there aren't many Southern voices that are on public radio.
Debbie Elliott.
On a national level. Just not, a handful. So it's really interesting. So you're not used to seeing people who talk like you in these prestige positions. And so you become to think that something's wrong with the way you speak.
And we sort of did that overall with the British accent as well. You know, a lot of Americans think that people in Britain sound more intelligent just because of that British accent.
Because they tend to be in prestige positions or they show up in movies and the important roles, although they're also the bad guy.
Well, the other thing that's curious to me is that a lot of Americans they're very delighted by, say, British sort of regional use of language, but they're very bothered when an American does it. So in other words, you know, if an American calls a redhead a ginger or talks about going on holiday, we feel like we're not allowed to speak that way.
Yeah. Well, and that sounds a little bit pretentious, I think, going on holiday. It's like pronouncing Paris, Paris.
I say it sometimes. I say both of those. What are you talking about?
Going on holiday?
You
never go on holiday.
But I spent some time. I worked with British people when I worked for Oxford University Press and Cambridge University Press, British companies, and I picked some stuff up.
Oh, yeah, you did.
And I studied French and lived in France, so I might actually occionally slip into Paris instead of Paris.
Yeah, I think we're both linguistic mutts. We're
we don't count, really.
Things that people call
say Paris, Texas, though.
That's good, because no one would know what you were talking about.
They'd run me out of town.
Are there such things, are there, we're going to be really careful here, but are there regional swear words? Are there things that are not acceptable to say in some parts of the English-speaking world?
Yeah, and there's some stuff that we can say that we don't have to be careful about. There are still parts of the country where if you say, that's a bull, people mentally extend that to the full form, mm-hmm. and they grow red-faced and offended. And they will not allow you to euphemize because they know what you mean. Where in other parts of the country, you get away with the euphemisms. You get away with abbreviating or shortening or making an acronym or initialism.
I don't think a week goes by without our getting the question, what does it mean to say, I swan? Do y'all say that here in Texas?
Swan. I swan? I don't think so.
Well, I swan?
Our producer just said his grandmother says it.
Oh, really? Right, right. And I think it's more common among the older generation, but it's a way of euphemizing, I swear. I mean, it literally means I shall warrant. But my grandmother used that as well.
But if you talk about swearing, you border on being offensive for some people in some areas.
Right, but
I
swan, you can get away with that.
Yeah.
So I want to talk a little bit about the show. First of all, how did you two start working together on this?
I was writing the railroads, and she was working in coal mines, and we just didn't know.
Well, so many of us in the language biz come to it in different ways. I mean, there's no real one prescribed way to do it. And I was in Kentucky writing books on word origins because I have a background in classical languages and also a background in journalism. And so I combined the two, writing books on word origins. And there were two previous co-hosts on the show, and one of them left. And so they did a nationwide search and found me writing books on word origins. And I came out and started doing the show with another host. And then we lost him. And fortunately, Grant showed up. Grant had been doing all kinds of things.
Yeah,
I had
been working for years with a sociolinguist, just kind of casually on my own, joined their organization, helped out, went to their conferences and read their journals and their books and all this sort of thing, and then became a dictionary editor specializing in slang and new words. I mean, really working on some top-notch projects that like really had a lot of talented people who were just teaching me. I mean, these are the kinds of jobs where I was typically the dumbest person in the room, which is a nice position
we
to
love
be
that.
In.
Yeah.
That's where I sit every day on the job, and I love it. A lot.
So absolutely.
I had done some small-time radio in the past. This job came open. I applied for it, sent in a tape, which was absolutely terrible. Mm-hmm. But the producer of our show, Stephanie Levine, who's really the spine of the operation.
Yes.
And she'll be in the heart. She'll be in town on Thursday. She said, I can make something of this piece of carbon. I can turn this guy into a diamond. And so far,
she
seems to be right. Yeah.
I had a horrible public speaking phobia, as a matter of fact.
Really?
But, yes, just terrible. But she knew that I played in a very, very bad rock band in Kentucky and thought I can do something with this because it's hard to make a linguist a radio person.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not a linguist,
But if you find somebody, here's what we do, I think, together. We take complicated subjects and we simplify them. And we both have this writer and editor's ability to simplify, to gather in a lot of data, find the key points, and then explain them, and hopefully well.
Yeah, yeah, and we're passionate about it. I mean, that's how I got over my public speaking phobia was, oh my gosh, I get to talk to people about language. Yes, I'll do it.
Oh, nerds. You have to be nerds to do this show.
You have to be nerds to be on the show as well, so it works out perfectly.
You know what? It turns out the nerds are winning in America. Judging by our email and phone calls, we outnumber everybody else.
It's sort of good to know, and I was talking a few months ago to the writer John Hodgman about this. Like, if someone had told me at 15 that nerds would be cool in 2013, I would have been so excited.
But this is, I mean,
we'd only known.
Take the joke out of it just a little bit. This shows that the pervasiveness of driving toward better education for everybody is working. Nerddom equals better education, in my opinion. We know a lot more about a lot more things, and that's a good thing.
What I love about your approach is that you're both so open to expressions you haven't heard, to things like slang. There is in language this idea of do you prescribe the right way to speak or do you describe the way people really speak? Mm-hmm. And how did you both find your way? I'm assuming that I can safely place you both in the descriptivist camp.
How dare you? Yes, you can.
Pretty much. Yeah.
Yeah. But what
did you wrestle with it?
Yeah, absolutely. And still every day, still. I mean, the older I get, the more curmudgeonly I become.
Yeah, and in a way, that's a core of the show, that that wrestling between descriptivism and
I call it a necessary friction. You must have these two sides, these two extremes, or one side says, you must speak like me in the way that I was taught, and this other side that says, whoa, wait a second. We got this cool thing here that we can do a lot of new things with. Why don't we try some stuff? And so you have these two sides occasionally meeting in the middle to bat it out. It's like the Rock'em Sock'em robots, you know? None of the blows really hit that hard, but occasionally a head is knocked off. It's just... It's got to happen. You have to have these gentle disputes from these two sides to really make people understand why language works well, when it works.
Why do you think we always assume that our ancestors were much more careful with this precious thing that is the English language than we are today?
We compare the best of the previous eras with the worst of our own era. This is a mistake that we make, not only in language, but in so many other fields. Mm-hmm. And it's a mistake, unequivocally a mistake. You can go back. I always say this. Go back and read the journals of Lewis and Clark. Clark was a gentleman, a farmer, widely respected, well-known by the political and social leaders of the day, somebody who had a lot of talents. But he was a terrible speller and a poor writer. And yet here's a man that we all know, at least his last name. Most of us can't remember his first name. We know what he did and how he did it, and movies have been made and books have been written about him. And the spelling wasn't a hindrance to him. He got his job done. And F. Scott Fitzgerald, you know, we've got the Great Gatsby out. Well, mm-hmm. Go look at his notes. He was a terrible speller. His editors they would just gently mock him all the time for how poor a speller he was. And yet he had the ideas, the drive. He knew what he wanted to do. He got it done, and he hired good help to get the job done. So I don't know if I've answered your question, but we're on a continuum of learning that doesn't stop until the day we die.
Yeah, and I think it happens from generation to generation that every generation thinks there was a golden era before us. I mean, even the ancient Greeks thought that.
Yeah, it's just not true. It simply isn't true. It's provably not true.
Yeah, and we're forever getting calls about the English language is going to hell in a handbasket. You know,
I wish it were changing. Because I've never seen a handbasket, and I want to find out what it looks like. That might be my only chance.
It is funny, though, that we think of certain expressions as being really dated in time and others last. I think of, you know, people say cool now. You know, you can meet someone who's 75 and they can sort of carry off saying, well, that's really cool. And mm-hmm. It used to be something that was very much the domain of young people.
Mm-hmm.
It's
mm-hmm.
true. One of my favorite ones to talk about is go back and look in newspapers, say about 100 or 110 years ago. The telephone had already caught on. It had started to move from these into the home, and people had started to abbreviate the word telephone as phone. And so these long screeds in the newspapers about how the word phone is this terrible piece of slang that nobody should ever use. And there is not a person alive today who would back up that argument. And yet at the time it was a thing. It was something to get upset about. And now a phone's not even a phone. I'm holding up my cell phone here. It's a computer, actually, right? The voice is the least of our phone these days.
Yeah, you think about how many minutes you use as compared with the time you use for data. And yeah. It's kind of crazy.
I think my wife and Martha are the only two people who ever call me on the voice line. Even text messaging. Yeah.
And you don't worry that all the kids and their texting is ruining the English language?
No, not at all. I think they're invigorating the English language because they're able to code switch. They're mm-hmm. able to
yeah.
switch from the texting language. I mean, all a teacher needs to do is correct them once on a paper, I would hope.
Yeah.
And then they pay a penalty for doing that.
And the thing is,
they know better.
There's a lot of things to unpack here. One is teens aren't the biggest texters necessarily. It's guys in their 20s. The second thing is we now have longitudinal data that show us that over the last 13 years or so of American texting, it turns out, and I'm holding my phone again, it turns out that the phones were holding us back. The reason we were coming up with all these shorthands and codes and kind of...
Before the QWERTY keyboards.
Yeah, because terrible keyboards. Now they're great. Now we have haptic response and good autocorrect, and we didn't have that. People want to write well, and their phones are not helping them do that.
I'm glad that I can use a semicolon now when I send a text, because it's really important sometimes.
Exactly.
I'm speaking this hour with Martha Barnett and Grant Barrett, who are co-hosts of Away with Words. They're in town for a fundraiser tomorrow night at the Lakewood Theater in Dallas to benefit the Aberg Center for Literacy. If you want to join our conversation now, call us. The number is 1-800-933-5372. Email address is think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering summer courses for adults in literature and languages, cultural history, and arts and design at the Dallas, Plano, and Taos, New Mexico campuses. Registration at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Grant Barrett and Martha Barnett, co-hosts of Away with Words. They're in town for a fundraiser event tomorrow night at the Lakewood Theater in Dallas to benefit the Aberg Center for Literacy. And now is your chance to not compete with the rest of the country if you've got a question for them. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. Before we take calls, the one question I have is, I'm always impressed when someone calls and you all have the information about how long a word or a phrase has been in use. And I'm wondering how this was done, like, before the era of Google, and if it's much, much easier now that you have a lot of things translated into digital form.
Oh, it was much, much harder. I had so many piles of index cards.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. And it required trips to the library, mm-hmm. you know, getting out of the house and into the car. And
these days, we both store giant quantities of data on our own laptops, stuff that either we've created or that we've gathered, stuff that maybe is behind paywalls that you just, you know, nobody else really has complete access to the exact archive that we have. So, and also, people tend to ask similar questions, and we've probably encountered your question before. We get 15,000 plus phone calls a year, 15,000 plus emails a year, plus all the tweets and Facebook posts and stuff. It's rare that we come across a question that we at least haven't read before, if not answered.
That alone should be confirmation that language does matter to people, that it's not going to hell in a handbasket. Right?
No, and anybody that you talk to who works in the language fields will tell you what we tell you, which is there is an insatiable desire to know more about language. Everybody I know is packed to the gills with questions from the public.
Yeah, anytime we give a talk and get to the Q&A part, there's a little pause before the first question, and then they just come rolling in,
and
it goes on and on and on. People are so curious about this stuff.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to the phones now. We'll speak with Steve in Euless. Hi, Steve.
Hey, Chris. Another great show,
and
three of my favorite people on the air. My God. Grant and Martha, you guys are amazing.
I go back to the days
of John Chardy. And he was a lot more professorial. You guys are so much more approachable. And I'll just love your show, and I promote it everywhere I can.
Oh, thank you so much. I love John Chardy, too.
It's nice
good
to be compared to him.
To
yeah, on John Chardy. He had
you
that
guys
voice.
Are in the same pantheon in my book.
Pantheon, wow.
Oh, when do I get
anyway, I wanted to add to your definitions of fixin' to and might could.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up, my grandmother taught in a one-room schoolhouse in Illinois, so I was brought up with all my Latin conjunctions and very proper Midwestern English. Lived in California, moved here to Texas in the 1980, and was always confused by fixin' to and might could, and finally got to know what the definition behind the definition is. Might could means to me, I'm perfectly capable. Fixin' to is it's on my list. Get off my back.
Ah.
I like those definitions.
Yeah, those are great. Might could is really interesting. It's throughout the American South. It's what we call, if I can be nerdy for a second, a double modal. A modal is might or should.
Mm-hmm.
And what you do is you double them up to mean even more uncertainty about what you're saying. It's more complex than that, but that's the brief version.
But I like his nuance there.
Yeah, I do. And because there's definitely a lot of nuance. If you want a really good coverage of this, look for the Dictionary of Smoky Mountain English.
Ugh.
Although it's about Appalachia and the way people speak there, most of it really applies throughout the South. And he's got Michael Montgomery has a really great explanation of this stuff.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Pat in Grand Prairie. Hi, Pat.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Great, thank you.
I'm interested in your show because I've been here, I was raised in Britain, but I've been here for about 40 years now, and it's really odd that everybody still thinks I have this British accent, which I don't think I do because I think that I assimilated. And I had to do that more or less to be understood because there were so many different little words that mean different things. I remember one time I had to call the electricity people because my range wasn't working. But I didn't call it a range. I called it a cooker. So they were asking me to describe it. And I was telling them, well, it's, you know, the top of the, where you cook on, and it's got four rings. And they went, oh, you mean the range or the stove? And I went, yes. But it was just little things like that. But I also noticed that when I go back to England, and I still live in the north, that I notice the announcers now are speaking in a northern dialect where they didn't used to do that.
It's really interesting.
Yeah, it's I can hear your accent. You definitely
I
have
hear a little bit, yeah.
I was going to think Lancashire. I don't know exactly where you're from, but it's really interesting. Well, the BBC overall, even in the domestic services, a few years ago, opened it up so there was no longer these RP, these received pronunciation mm-hmm. accents, these posh voices, and they started inviting people with Indian accents and Caribbean accents besides the regional accents in the UK. I don't think they've gone as far accepting the American service to invite Americans to mm-hmm. broadcast in the UK to UK listeners.
It's interesting that people feel very like they sort of own the way their broadcasters sound, right? I mean, there's a sense that we have an expectation that people will come across with a certain kind of voice.
You want them to sound like you, right?
Yeah, I guess that's right. And everybody thinks they sound like the people on TV, even if they've got a... Did you ever notice that?
Yeah,
even if they've got a really kind of strong regional accent.
Oh, but I mean, I just have to take a second. When sociolinguists study this stuff, one of the things they find again and again is they will go out in the field and record somebody and say, oh, by the way, you did do this particular curious thing with your dialect.
Right.
And the person will say, well, no, I don't. And then the researcher will play the tape back, and the subject will still say, no, I'm sorry, I don't hear what you're saying to me. And then they will show them the waveform on the computer and show that, like, for example, they pronounce pen, P-E-N, and P-I-N identically. And they're like, well, no, I don't actually do that. People don't really know their own speech nearly as well as they think they do.
We have an email here from Steve who writes, my dad always used the saying, you ain't a wolfin'. I took that to mean you are not telling a lie. Am I near the target here?
Mm. Yeah, that is a phrase that is quite common in the African-American community. And, for example, to sell wolf tickets is to be doing exactly that.
So sell a load of malarkey.
Yeah, yeah, to be deceiving somebody. Or if you're trying to convince somebody that you're not deceiving them, you say, I ain't selling wolf tickets. And I think wolfing around has the same same idea.
Wolf tickets. That sounds kind of cute, like some exhibition at the zoo or something. Let's go back to, let's see, we'll skip over that one. Let's go back to Michael in Dallas. Want to be careful to watch our language here, even though this is a show for adults. Michael in Dallas. Hi.
Hi. My question is about the use of the word so, S-O, and it started, really my question kind of started about less than 2 years ago listening to NPR, and the host asked the question, and whoever it was answered the question starting with the word so, and it was totally irrelevant, inappropriate kind of use of the word, and I noticed it, and then I started noticing a lot of guests answering questions starting with the word so. Sometimes it was appropriate but kind of unnecessary, and then other times it really didn't belong there. And now I've noticed it in conversation. I've noticed I use the word more. And the other night I was having dinner with friends, and a guy was telling some stories, and when he would begin something, he would say, so, this was the situation, you know, or whatever. And I know there must be a name or a way of identifying this kind of phenomena and this where a word starts getting used like that. And I wonder what would be other examples and how would you describe that?
Well, I'm curious about the answer here because I've gotten complaint emails that I do this when I start a question occasionally.
Oh, really?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, you all are not the only people who have noticed this. Linguists have noticed it, and they refer to it as the sentence initial so. And we're not sure where it started, but I've heard some theorizing that perhaps it comes from the language of Silicon Valley or...
Microsoft. People at Microsoft claim that they started it in the early 90s.
Really?
Yeah, they have long screeds about this. I don't know if there's anything to it, but...
Well, and excuse me, their idea is that engineers are talking about a sequence mm-hmm. of events, and so everything starts with a so, because it's and then. So they start mid, or they start at the beginning with so.
Right. Well, it works the same way as the word well. Hmm. Most of our listeners probably wouldn't have a problem with, well, the answer to your question is, right? We might mm-hmm. think you overuse it a little bit, or we might think that perhaps you could get away with not using it. But it's so, because of its newness, is kind of catching their ear. We will all be comfortable with it in 20 or 30 years.
Yeah, and look and see are other words like that. I remember during the presidential campaign, John Kerry used one of those and George Bush used the other. I don't remember who used which,
right.
But one used look, such and such and such, and the other used see.
So what these are, just to go up the conversation tree a little bit, these are attention getters. So they draw your ear and your mind mm-hmm. to what is about to follow. They kind of say, mm-hmm. pay attention. So and well and look and see in this particular case are doing this job. Now, all of these words have other jobs in English, but in this, at the beginning of a sentence, they do that one job, and they do it very well.
Yeah, it's sort of like grabbing the microphone or the talking stick.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, or the conch.
1-800, that didn't work out well. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Dia in Dallas. Hi, Dia.
Hi. I have been meaning to call Grant and Martha for years.
What's holding you back?
There you are.
12 years ago, when I was gestating my first son, I heard a word that described the metamorphosis that takes place when a child is born. First, I'm a non-parent, and then I become a parent by virtue of having a child. And there was a word that someone used to describe that metamorphosis.
Huh.
Tiredness?
Sleep deprivation? Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. If you haven't had a child, then you're nulliparous. N-U-L-L-I-P-A-R-O-U-S.
So then would be post-nulliparous if you have a child?
Or paris, I think.
Okay.
Hmm. Like the null is like no or nothing.
There we go.
But does that sound right? I'm not sure about the paris, but nulliparous means you haven't had a child. Does that ring
a
bell for you?
I realize you spelled it, but now I'm holding like a pen to spell it as well. So can you spell it again?
N-U-L-L-I-P-A-R-O-U-S. I feel like I'm back at the spelling bee.
Yeah, ding, ding, champion.
And so that means that you have not begotten a child.
Correct.
Yeah.
And so the phenomenon of then having a child.
I'm guessing it's P-A-R-O-U-S, but I'm sure somebody will let
us know. Something like
it's
something like that. Yeah, because multiparous means that you have more than one child, or that you have twins,
oh, yeah,
right? Or you have a multiple birth, I believe.
Okay. See, we're all learning stuff.
Yeah, I believe so. But if she's given you enough material here, I think you should be able to Google this now, because this will tend to appear with other words of its kind. And Martha is also demonstrating her Latin and Greek understanding here. She's got these roots down cold, and it comes up again and again.
We have our Googling expert in the next room, Jeff, who says it is P-A-R-O-U-S.
So yes.
You totally.
Ding, 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 ding.
Candy bar for Martha. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have an email here from Teresa in Bedford who wants to know what the Way With Words team, I guess you guys are a united front here,
yes,
thinks about speech-to-type programs like Dragon.
If you need them, I mean, because if you have disabilities, they're a godsend. They're utterly irreplaceable, and people can do jobs now that they couldn't do, say, 20 or 30 years ago when this technology didn't exist or wasn't mature enough. Go for it. I don't know exactly where she's going with the question.
She wanted to know if it would help spelling or cause people to think less about writing.
I know there are a number of professional writers who have gone on the record saying that that's how they write these mm-hmm. days, because they feel like the speech that comes out of their mouths is more genuine and true to the language than the stuff that they type with their hands, because there's less second guessing yourself on the spot. You save the second guessing for your editing, you know, and you're a better editor to yourself, because you're harsher when the stuff that comes out of your head doesn't actually travel through your fingers and your keyboard.
Yeah, I would encourage her to experiment, because you speak differently from the way you write. It's mm-hmm. a different way of organizing your thoughts.
Yeah.
They're also really fun to play with and speak quickly. My kids will do this and then see how garbled the text translation of what you've just said becomes.
It is staggering how much better they are than they were even 10 years ago. Amazing, amazing.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Bruce in Dallas. Hi, Bruce.
Hello, how are you?
Great, thank you.
Well, I was just, y'all talking about Southern and type of cuss words. I can remember back in 1965, I was 10 years old, and my dad had a farm in addition to his practice of being a doctor. And I can remember the segregation, you know, about white drinking water and all that type of stuff that I was disgusted with. But anyway, I can remember old white men would use the word John Brown as a cuss word.
Just Google that guy and the anti-abolitionist and the abolitionist kind of arguments all come back to you. Your school studies will come up when you'll just remember how important it was to have a side, to pick a side and to fight against the other side when that was an important thing. Yeah, turning that man's name into a cuss word kind of showed where you stood.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also email think. Let's see. We have Patty wants to know if you've heard this phrase, raking up a dead snake. She says, I grew up in East Texas and heard my mother say it. It basically means bringing up a subject that no one wants to think about.
Oh, nice.
Like, I hate to rake up a dead snake, but summer's almost over and school starts.
That one's going in the file.
Yep,
thank you for that.
Making notes.
That's,
thanks.
That's
never
a
heard
gem,
it.
Raking up a dead snake.
Yeah. Well, I've heard something along those lines. It means the same thing. I'm going to put a spider in your biscuit or on your biscuit. It's more like I'm going to tell you bad news.
Oh, okay.
I guess that's a little bit
spider
different.
Spider in your biscuit.
Spider on your biscuit.
No.
It just makes you really grateful that we have like refrigeration now. And
seriously.
Sort of yeah. Do you each have like, are you always carrying a notebook or I guess now you can add to your phone something
right.
interesting that you hear?
Yeah. And I use Google's to-do list actually is my notepad, and I got an email from them a while back telling me that I'd exceeded their limits. I mean, I literally have tens of thousands of things in there.
So
we'll go through that. The little tidbits that you hear between calls come from just the reading that we do and the stuff that comes up in calls like, you know, radio interviews and Q&As in public and that sort of thing.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. The email address is think@kera.org. We're speaking this hour with Martha Barnett and Grant Barrett, co-hosts of Away With Words. You can hear it on this station Saturdays at 1 o'clock. And they're in town for a fundraiser event tomorrow night at the Lakewood Theater in Dallas to benefit the Aberg Center for Literacy. We'll be back to the conversation in about 2.5 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering summer courses for adults in literature and languages, cultural history, and arts and design at the Dallas, Plano, and Taos, New Mexico campuses. Registration at smu.edu/CAPE.
You are listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Martha Barnett and Grant Barrett, hosts of Away With Words. They're in town for a fundraiser event tomorrow night at the Lakewood Theater in Dallas that will benefit the Aberg Center for Literacy. If you'd like to join the conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Okay, because since I'm sitting here with you, I want to ask my one question. My grandmother, who was born in 1913, when something startled her, would say, and I think I might have written to you about this, and you did not, I didn't expect you to put it on the show, but she would say, "Holy Mother of God, Saint Michael, and all the Protestant saints." And I don't know, I've never been able to Google it, I've never found it anywhere, and I just wonder, she was a very good Catholic, and her, you know, uncle was a priest, and is this something, she was from Ohio, is this something you've ever heard of? Or
no, I've heard of people saying, Saint Pete or Holy Pete, but I guess she needed a lot more saints.
It was almost like she was. It was almost like she was swearing a blue streak, but instead she was. She was
like
just
word.
You know saying things that were acceptable,
right? And not quite exactly swearing though.
Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. Never heard it.
Yeah.
She must have been one of a kind.
She was one of a kind. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Jack in Dallas. Hey, Jack.
Well, hey there. Thanks for taking my call, and welcome to Dallas, Grant and Martha.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jack. We are feeling very, very welcome.
Well, very good. I enjoy your show, which I listen to on KERA on Saturdays, but I've wanted to call in before, but you just seem a lot more accessible, I guess, here on Chris's show, so I decided to call in today. And I have a question. I'm curious if a phrase my mother used to use is colloquial or if you've heard it before. When we were children, I grew up in a small town south of Houston, actually, called Wharton, Texas. And we as kids used to use the phrase, you know, when you were looking for someone, where's Daddy at? Or where is Rob at? And my mother invariably would answer the question with, oh, he's between the A and the T.
Have you all heard that?
No.
Haven't heard that one.
But parents are very good at coming up with these things to kind of point out that you've said something incorrectly.
Yeah, yeah. And that's a bugaboo for a lot of people. I mean, a lot of people talk to us and they end a sentence with a preposition and then they get all flustered. But ending a sentence with a preposition is fine. I mean, the at there is redundant, but that old prohibition goes back to people trying to apply Latin rules to English, and they don't really apply in
that
case.
But with where's Daddy at, you can do without the at, and you might as well leave it off.
Yeah, that's what I mean. It's
redundant. And it's what's interesting. There's been some speculation among linguists that the at is behaving like a verb and not a preposition.
Hmm.
Okay,
where's
explain
daddy
that.
Adding?
Yeah, they're adding. Like daddy, or daddy acts wherever he is.
Oh,
daddy
okay.
exists.
Oh.
Daddy is.
Wow.
Yeah, but it's weak.
Yeah.
Okay, we have an email here from Frank who says, when I listen to news items from the BBC, I hear them say someone is in hospital instead of in the hospital. And Frank wants to know which is correct.
Both.
Depends on where you are.
Yeah, there's no one English. There are multiple Englishes in the UK. There are many Englishes, even in the United States. And what happens with that is there's some very concrete dialect rules that say you say in hospital or at university, mm-hmm. Whereas in the United States you don't. It's mm-hmm. just simply a choice of how you perceive the place. Is it a canonical hospital? Do you mean a particular hospital? You just mean an institution? There's all these different local rules.
Yeah. Chris, do you say I'm in studio or do you say I'm in the studio or the studio?
I guess I always say in the studio, but I might say in studio guests.
Oh, okay. Well, right. Yeah, that's functioning as an adjective.
Right, here we go. Yeah,
hyphenated,
yeah.
I hope.
Yeah, so it's totally fine. If you're British, it's fine. It's normal to do. If you're American, you're going to sound weird and you probably ought not to do it.
Someone will point it out to you and then call into a radio show and
you're
complain.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's check in with David in Irving. Hi, David.
Hi. Love the show. Love all three of your shows.
Thank you.
Yay.
So I'm calling because I grew up in the 70s and 80s here in the Dallas area, and it seems when I was growing up, everybody had regional accents in the United States, and obviously they still do. The R's don't happen in New York or Boston very often, but I'm also noticing, and maybe this is reality television, that it seems that more people nationally tend to have sort of like a Valley accent or something like that. Just wondering if y'all have any observations, if you've noticed this, and what your thoughts are.
Can you tell us what you mean by a Valley accent? Can you do an impression?
Well, here's an example. They'll say important with no T's. Like, it's very important. That kind of thing. So it's, maybe I'm not being specific enough, but it just seems like there are less, regional accents can be less pronounced sometimes, although I know they still exist, obviously, and probably always will. Does that help?
Yeah, I think it does. There's a couple of things happening here. First, television is not a good mirror for reality. So let's just accept that the producers of those shows are largely choosing their guests from major urban centers where their languages are very pronounced, have particular characteristics. Like they don't often come to, say, Galveston and set one of these shows. They do it in New Jersey and New York and Los Angeles and not many other places. Maybe, I mean, the Real Housewives shows are here and there, but really, so you're not getting a full picture. But the second thing is this, I think a question that you kind of asked but didn't ask, but I'm going to answer is, are we all starting to sound alike? And the answer is no. And people are really shocked to hear that. The dialects and the regional accents are more pronounced now than ever before. Doesn't mean they haven't changed, but they're changing to something new. We sound as much like our neighbors now as we used to. We sound like the people we buy our groceries from. We sound like the people who teach our kids in school. We sound like the mailman. We sound like our family, of course. We sound like our best friends. We don't tend to sound like newscasters or people that we see on TV. The third thing I would say is the word important is really interesting because a lot of things can happen with that first T. It can flap, important, right? Important. Mm-hmm. And it can glottalize, important, mm-hmm. right? And these two things happen in naturally in the mouths, particularly of American or North American speakers. And so that's what you're hearing about that particular word.
It seems like the important is a very sounds very Southern to me. Like you hear mm-hmm. that
yes.
most
Absolutely.
Often
mm-hmm.
in Texas
Absolutely.
A lot.
Yeah. Yeah. When we talk about flapping of a butter, for example, no American except somebody who's incredibly pretentious says butter.
Right.
We all say butter. It sounds like D's. But that's the most common example of that mm-hmm. T turning into a D mm-hmm. sound.
And we talked about that Manhattan or the mm-hmm. important on the show
yeah.
that's called a glottal.
Yeah.
Glottal stop.
Glottalization,
yeah. I think.
Yeah. I really like reality TV because people are speaking largely unscripted, but there's a heavy amount of editing as well to really and also they're in performance mode. This
yeah.
is like I guess this is the fourth thing. People on these shows are aware of cameras. They've been briefed by producers. Sometimes the producers will have them redo scenes multiple times, and then it's all edited where a lot of stuff is taken out. You are not getting really natural speech. It's not truly natural. So it's not very good to use it for much more than, say, picking up the odd bit of new slang or a new word or a few small things. But no field worker could do very much with that and feel like they were confident in their results.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Milton in Fort Worth. Hi, Milton.
Hi. I have a thing that happens with my wife, I use the term figuratively a lot, and she corrects me a lot of times. She says that what you really mean is actually, as opposed to figuratively, like, you know, I just sort of blurt out, like, I was figuratively the first in line, or something that, and is this, like, creeping into our, like, common speech? Putting figuratively in front of things that aren't really figurative.
Sounds like it's crept into your speech. If you say I'm figuratively at the front of the line, are you really at the front of the line? Are you literally at the front of the line?
Yeah, I just couldn't think of a better example. But I hear the term figuratively used a lot when in fact it doesn't seem to be figurative. It seems to be actual.
No, I am not familiar with that. I've certainly heard people complain about literally.
We are going to have to go trolling to looking for more information on this. That's kind of, now that you've brought it to our attention, I wouldn't be surprised that we see it more often.
You think that's a response maybe to people's irritation with the overuse of literally?
I wonder if it is.
You know,
I literally died.
Oh, hypercorrecting in the other direction.
Yeah,
interesting.
Yeah.
Well, you know what? We're going to have to look into this, and you may hear it come up on the show if we find out more, all right?
All right. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's see. Let's go to Bob in Bedford. Hey, Bob.
Hello.
Hi.
One of my questions was partially answered about the Britishisms in hospital, in university. I was curious as to whether that had come up just recently, because I don't seem to remember it from 15 or 20 years ago.
In British, you didn't hear that in British speech 15 or 20 years ago?
I'm not aware of it. Hmm. It seems to be arising more often here lately.
It is. It's got a long, long history. If I could just guess here, probably what's happening is there is a lot more British media in the United States these days than there used to be, partly through PBS and NPR. BBC is often played all night on public radio stations across the country. Downton Abbey, of course, is a huge hit. So it's possible that you have just increased your British media intake and don't have a good older data set to compare it to, if I can fall into researcher speak.
Yes, we talk about the recency illusion all the time, about the fact that there's so many phenomena in language that we think are recent, and it turns out they're much, much older. I mean, the word cool, for example, goes way,
from 1950s
way
at least.
Back.
And it's still slang, which is interesting. It hasn't been standardized yet.
I think what I love about listening to the show is that when you guys are sort of stumped, it seems to be the most exciting thing
for
that
us.
Ever happens to you.
For us, yeah, we get thrilled. And, oh my gosh!
To be dumb, to be dumb in front of a national audience is an important thing. I mean, if we can just elevate this to another level, there's a certain type of person who always wants to be right, and if we were those people, our show would be a huge failure.
It would be not much fun to call in.
No, certainly not. So for us, we have no problem just saying, I don't know. You tell us. Put the call out there. You'll hear us say that. We're putting the call out to you, send us email, phone calls, and then we'll get a flood of information, and we'll learn something. And I think that's what we have in common with our listeners, why we find wherever we go, including Dallas, people are simpatico because we all have this drive to learn. Martha and I and our listeners will never stop. And so being the dumbest person in the room is one way to look at
it. It's a blast.
But seeing it as a learning opportunity is a better way to look at it.
Do you get like angry retorts to things that you have come down on?
Yes, and they usually start out, you of all people.
How dare you, sir? I'm outraged.
Oh, yeah.
The one that I get the most, and I'm surprised we haven't had calls about it, or maybe
I'm
we have.
I'm surprised, too. And I know
just,
what you're going
to
say.
You're just too polite probably to put them on the air. It's people say, Grant, why do you say often with a T? Because many people in this country were told that that was an uneducated pronunciation. But the other half of the country that, like me, says often is like, what are you talking about? I learned this from my father who learned it from his parents, and this is how it goes. It's one of those places where we have these little – we allow ourselves to insult other people about language in a way that we wouldn't do about anything else. We would not insult them about their religion or their race or their sexuality or their gender in a way that we do about language. We are unabashed to criticize a stranger for saying something that actually turns out to be perfectly fine if you have the same history, come from the same part of the country as I do. It's really interesting. And I will get emails now also from other often sayers instead of often who will say, thank you for saying that. Everybody I know says that, and except for this one person who tells all of the rest of us that we're wrong. And that's one of these unreasonable approaches to language that just doesn't get you anywhere, to just criticize people wholesale without stepping back and going, wait a second. If all these people are saying this, there's got to be something there. What can I find out? What's the history here? What do they all have in common? Well, you'll usually find they come from particular parts of the country. You'll usually find that they're not stupid. You know, they have degrees and education and are well-respected. So just calling somebody stupid because they say something like often isn't a good answer. Or whatever you choose. Whatever word you choose is the bugaboo that makes you call people uneducated.
So when you sit down on a plane and you don't feel like talking to your seatmate for 4 hours, do you tell them you're like a tax accountant or something else?
Never feels like not talking to people.
That's not
Are
true.
You kidding?
Well, here's the fun thing is most people, until they hear the show, think it's going to be incredibly boring.
Oh, yeah. They think we're knuckle-wrapping.
Like school.
You know, I'd like to talk to you today about the subjunctive and the history of the subjunctive in Old Latin.
That's what they think it's going to be. Yeah. Two dusty school marms with like tattered corduroy jackets who haven't left the ivory tower.
Well, have I got news for them?
Yeah.
Yeah, and they realize they're really interested in what we're talking
and
about.
Then
they
have
questions.
And then the next
then
response,
they
once they
stop.
Realize, like, oh, I have this question I've been sitting on for 30 years. And we're like, well, what took you so long? I've got a word for you. It's called Google.
Martha Barnett and Grant Barrett are co-hosts of Away With Words. You can hear it on this station every Saturday afternoon at 1 o'clock. They're in town for a fundraiser event tomorrow night at the Lakewood Theater in Dallas to benefit the Aberg Center for Literacy. It's been so great to have you both here. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Chris.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can download that podcast free at kera.org/think and comment, question, or suggest something for the show at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.